I'd rather hope that I could refrain, and I'll try to do as good a job of refraining and restraining myself as I can. I'm not at all sure about what Mr. Rose is saying. I commend to you an article that you may not have read. It's listed in the little brochure over here, advertising the Journal of Law and Economics. And I commend to you very highly an article written by Ron Coase called The Problem of Social Costs. I hope you read it several times. It took me at least 10 before I really understood what he was talking about. But there's an element in there that is applicable to the other side, or a sort of a assertion, I think he's right, that says that the interventionists have focused occasionally, almost inevitably and constantly, upon the imperfections of the market. And having found that that things are really not perfect, which should hardly be remarkable, they have decided that the market was responsible and that therefore social activity is the way, in some fashion, to correct it. And in so doing, they have completely disregarded the costs. That there are costs associated with all these things. And this is a little bit of what bothers me with Mr. Rose's position. I agree with Mr. Friedman. There is a big difference between government and private arrangements. And that big difference is indeed whether or not one can compel the use of other people's resources. When somebody says, "What shall we do for thus and so?" they usually mean, "How can you and I get together and take it away from him for purposes of which we approve?" Now, it's not as clear-cut as it seems. When businessmen engage in certain activities which they frequently call social responsibility or contributing to the delights of the local community in some fashion, I get a little bit nervous. I think I'm most nervous because I'm sort of afraid they believe it. Now, still, I wouldn't stop them. But there is the difference, in a sense, between the two arrangements. Because if somebody says, "I ought to, or we ought to, as XYZ company, we ought to go into Watts or someplace and provide jobs," and I'm not making this up out of the air, and if I happen to be a stockholder in that man's company, and if he really intends to take some of the resources of that company and use it for this purpose, at least in terms of the original argument, he's saying it without regard to the costs. He's making, in a sense, the same mistake, economically speaking, that the interventionists are making, according to Mr. Coase's estimate. And I don't think it's any better in one than in the other. I do think there's a difference. The difference is that if I'm a stockholder and an owner in that company, and I really believe this is not precisely to my advantage, if I do nothing and say nothing, I will bear all of the responsibility, or if you like, I will bear all of the loss of wealth associated with that action during the time that I say nothing and do nothing. But I have one way out. I have the possibility of selling my ownership in that business. And I urge you sometimes to try this when you get in a meeting of a corporation of some sort. When the president is telling you what a wonderful job of social work is being done by the officers and others in that corporation, say to him, you're rather interested in this and you hadn't thought about it before, and you'll have to go back now and see whether you shouldn't sell your stock. because you're not so sure whether he ought to be giving your resources away in this fashion. I think that some of the time he'll turn around and tell you that there are some other reasons for what he's doing. And he may very quickly talk about the advantages of goodwill in the community and the image of the product and things of this sort. And I do believe there's some of this. But I'd much rather we face that kind of problem squarely rather than doing it on a basis which I would regard as somewhat emotional. This is by no means the end-all and be-all. I think we have a remarkable opportunity here. I think we have a remarkable opportunity today. I'm a little uncomfortable. At the meeting out in San Francisco, there were a lot of wide varieties of differences of points of view on the part of the young people. There were even some long hairs. They disturbed me. I have to gulp a little bit because I don't like it. And I'm not at all sure if I had political power that I wouldn't put a stop to it. But leaving that out, I've tried to contact them a little bit. And you know, one thing that you find here is that there are a wide variety of ideas here. They range from the avowed Marxist, Moist, on the one side, to the bohemian, to the hippie, to the intellectual anarchist, if you like, on the other. But they have one very strong thing in common. They hate the Great Society. They hate its guts. And this gives us some possibilities. I'm not overly confident, but it gives us some possibilities. The two ways I suppose we could go would be one to try to convince them on some kind of an emotional basis. The other, I suppose, is to try to convince them on some kind of a reasoned, scientific basis. My own views are clearly toward the latter, although for tactical reasons, I won't prevent other people from going the other direction. We've got a terrific job to do. It's a job that requires a division of labor that nobody can direct and nobody should direct. I'm not sure of the independent sector, whatever that means. I think we've had a big independent sector. I think it's done a terrific job. Some people call it the market. I think it does a terrific job every day, not because of love of mankind, but because of self-interest. And I happen to think that self-interest is probably the governing factor. Oh, people will say other things, and they'll explain their actions differently. But when you come right down to it, most of the time, it's self-interest. I would find it hard if a businessman came to me, or anybody else for that matter, and said, well, what can I do? I'm afraid I'd say to him what Mr. Rose probably wouldn't agree with. I'd say to him, do what you want to do. It's your resources. If a young man whom I met not too long ago in a barber shop, and it was kind of strange, he was arguing with a barber, and he was a student at one of the state colleges, not a private one. He was arguing with the barber on the basis that the barber had been complaining about the various and sundry activities going on among some of the welfare programs, the economic opportunities program, things like this. The barber didn't know what to call it, but he didn't like it. The youngster made some great complaints, and he emotionally said, well, you know what you're doing. You're keeping these people in ghettos and that sort of thing. And I asked him why, if he felt this way, he didn't move down there with them. Clearly there was nothing preventing him from doing so. But if he thought this was really desirable, He could give of his resources to them to the extent that he had resources. But it seemed a different thing to compel the barber, who clearly had different values, to give his resources in the process. And this, I'm very much afraid, is where we run into some real difficulties. Now, there are a batch of other things we could do. The alternatives to the welfare state are almost infinite. Welfare state. My favorite definition of the welfare state belongs to Ralph Harris. He has this, get him to give you one sometime, but some of you will remember that delightful writing by Ambrose Bierce called The Devil's Dictionary. And he has a variety of wonderful little definitions. Bierce does, that is, including such things as harangue, a speech by a political opponent, who is called an orangutan, or prejudice, some other people's tastes with which you disagree, that sort of thing. Well, Ralph put together one of these and has a whole lot of things in it: new economics, incomes policies, netties, nickies, and so on. And among them is the definition of the welfare state. And he said, welfare state, a compulsory arrangement for taking in each other's inadequate incomes. This was, in a sense, a steal, too, because somebody long years ago, and I've forgotten who it was, had a description of the Scilly Islanders, who were wont to support themselves by taking in each other's laundry. I'm sorry. I used this in a paper in Japan, and we had a multiple arrangement, Japanese on one side and Americans on the other, and this caused great consternation among the Japanese. They wondered what I was talking about Sicily for. So we tried to explain it, and I couldn't remember all the details because my geography is not good, and I didn't know where the Scilly Islands were. I knew they were somewhere off Britain. And Arthur Shenfield came to my rescue and added a great deal to the discussion by pointing out that this was the place where Mr. Wilson now spent his summer vacations out there. Well, I don't have any simple answer. We can dream up, I'm sure, a dozen ways of getting around this. But if we do it in such a way that we achieve what I think are humanitarian ends, and which, even though we may not disagree, we may not agree with all of them, are certainly worthy of consideration, there are more ways than one of achieving it. And there are ways of achieving it by such devices as the negative income tax, such devices as opting out, such devices as vouchers, such devices as putting the progression, if any, on states, on the number of recipients, and not on on each recipient, and not on the entire estate, and so on. There are just dozens and dozens of ways in which it is possible to blunt the effect of the intervention. And I think that the job of all of us, jobs, I should say, one, to dream up the ways of blunting it, and two, to convince other people of the rightness and indeed the more efficient arrangements that we can suggest. Thank you.